Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 13, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the 10th anniversary of Heller. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Nelson Lund, a Professor of Law at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, Professor Daryl Miller, Professor of Law at Duke University School of Law, and as our moderator, we have Dr. Robert Leiter, an associate at Arnold and Porter, D.C., and an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law School. After hearing from our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for joining us. Robert, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and good afternoon. This June marks the 10th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in District of Columbia versus Heller. By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in the militia and to use that arm for traditionally lawful purposes, including self-defense within the home. Although Heller answered whether the Second Amendment is an individual or collective right, Justice Scalia's opinion for the court has been criticized by scholars both on the left and on the right. Over the past 10 years, lower courts have also grappled with Heller's implications. Plaintiffs have brought challenges to laws that restrict the ability to carry firearms in public, ban the possession of certain semi-automatic firearms deemed assault weapons, and prohibit the possession of firearms by people convicted of certain crimes. With a few notable exceptions, lower courts have rebuffed these challenges and generally read Heller to be consistent with strict regulation of firearms. Today, we will have a debate about the original meaning of the Second Amendment, Heller, and whether lower courts are faithfully applying the Supreme Court's decision. With me are Professors Nelson Lund and Daryl Miller. Professor Lund is presently a university professor at the Antonin Scalia School of Law and served from 2003 through 2013 as Patrick Henry Professor of Constitutional Law and the Second Amendment. Professor Miller is the Melvin G. Shim Professor of Law at Duke University School of Law. Both have published extensively on the Second Amendment, and we are excited to have them here today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we jump in, let me briefly describe our debate format. Initially, I will ask questions. Professors Lund and Miller will each have 2 minutes to respond with an optional 1 minute rebuttal. And after about 40 minutes of debate, we will open it up for audience questions. So with that, I would like to begin by asking our panelists to give us a brief summary of Heller. And Professor Lund, could you start us off by giving us the factual background of the case and explain Justice Scalia's majority opinion?
Okay, let me start with the Second Amendment. I guess most people on this call are familiar with what it says, but I'll just quote it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Heller was a Second Amendment test case brought to challenge the District of Columbia's disarmament law, which forbade civilians to possess a handgun or an operable rifle or shotgun. There was almost no relevant precedent, so the court undertook an investigation of the original meaning of the Second Amendment. The threshold issue was whether the Second Amendment protects an individual right to the private ownership of firearms or a right of the state governments to maintain militia organizations. Justice Scalia's majority opinion begins with a detailed textual and historical argument in support of the individual right interpretation. He concludes that the right of the people refers to an individual right, just as the identical language in the First and Fourth Amendments does. The Constitution does not refer to a right of the states or to a right of the militia or a right of militia men. Scalia emphasizes that the right of the people to keep and bear arms was already recognized in a long legal tradition going back to Great Britain, where it had always been a private individual right to have weapons needed for self-defense, either against common criminals or against a would-be tyrant. The prefatory phrase in the Second Amendment merely explains why this pre-existing legal right was codified in the Constitution. because the traditional militia consisted of all able-bodied adult men, a federal law disarming these individuals would effectively disable the militia and leave the people vulnerable to oppression by a politicized federal military organization. Scalia offers extensive evidence in support of these threshold conclusions. For the moment, I'll just say that there is no record that anyone articulated the state's right interpretation during the founding period or for many decades thereafter. After demonstrating that the Constitution protects an individual right that serves the natural or inherent right of self-defense, Scalia concluded that the D.C. handgun ban was unconstitutional. Because this law was a prohibition on an entire class of arms that Americans choose for the lawful purpose of self-defense, Scalia maintained that it would have to be struck down under any of the standards of scrutiny that the court has applied to enumerated constitutional rights. He then discusses and endorses a number of exceptions to Second Amendment protection, which we might want to discuss a little later. I'll just conclude by saying that I don't agree with everything in Scalia's opinion, but I do think that his principal threshold conclusions are solid, and I also think that the D.C. handgun ban was unconstitutional because it infringed on that right without sufficient justification.
Thank you, Professor Lawton. So in addition to Justice Scalia's majority opinion, there were two dissents, one by Justice Stevens and another by Justice Breyer. Professor Miller, could you please summarize those?
I'd love to. So Stephen wrote a dissent in which he adopted what may be called an originalist or at least a heavily historically inflected approach, contra to Justice Scalia's not approach, but his reasoning. In other words, both Justice Stevens and Justice Scalia rely on history and text, but come to different conclusions with respect to the right. So in Justice Stevens' reasoning, the issue was about the scope of the amendment, not about whether it was, quote-unquote, individual. In his opinion, saying that the right is individual doesn't say anything about the kinds of uses it protects. There was nothing in the Second Amendment, according to Justice Scalia, that itself indicated that it was meant to constitutionalize any common law right to self-defense. In Justice Stevens' dissent, he noted that the founders knew how to protect personal uses of firearms. They knew the words self-defense, and they didn't use either formulations in the Second Amendment, as contrasted with some contemporary state-level rights declarations in Pennsylvania and Vermont, which did encode a personal use terminology. Justice Stevens suggested that the proper way to read the amendment was to read it forward from the well-regulated militia clause to the end, and not, as Justice Scalia had done, read it backwards, starting from the latter, quote-unquote, operative half and working forward. He adds his opinion that if, in fact, that operative section was so clear as to not need any clarifying preamble, it wouldn't have taken 18 pages of majority opinion to explain. Reasoning from the beginning of the amendment to its end was the normal way a reader of English construes text and would have been the way an 18th century speaker of English would have used, have understood this terminology as well. With the militia purpose in mind, to keep and bear arms, the phrase bear arms derives from the Latin meaning to carry war equipment and was overwhelmingly used in a military context at the time of the framing of the Constitution. And it was that meaning that was most common, as is evidenced by the repeated use of bear arms in a military context and not the general carry weapons construction of the majority. Stevens notes in a footnote in his dissent that the professors of linguistics had filed an amicus brief that documented 115 contemporaneous texts with the Second Amendment, and they had all used the term bear arms in a military context except for five of those texts. Keep, according to Justice Stevens merely recognized that the arms could be born that would be born for militia duty could be kept in a private home and not necessarily in a depot or armory. And to keep and bear arms then is a unitary idea, meaning to both have a right and a duty to have arms ready for military service in the militia. Reading it this way, in his words, shows that the right was one to, quote, secure the people a right to use and possess arms in conjunction with service in a well-regulated militia. Moreover, according to Justice Stevens, this had been the overwhelming construction of this provision from its enactment from Miller up until 2008 when Heller was decided. The majority, according to Justice Stevens, wanted it to seem like conservators, but what they were really engaging in was a form of judicial activism, according to his dissent, by construing the Second Amendment in a way that it escaped the wisdom of over 200 years of jurists prior. Simultaneously, according to the dissenting opinion, it was inviting lower courts to engage in a case-by-case oversight of firearms policy that Justice Stevens thought was unwise. Justice Breyer also wrote a dissent. He joined Stevens' dissent, but wrote separately to pursue his practical objections to the majority opinion. His point was that the gun control regulation met constitutional muster, even if one believed that the Second Amendment protected some kind of right to keep and bear arms for private purposes like individual self-defense. His point was twofold. First, that the kind of regulation here was sufficiently tailored to the specific problem of urban gun violence caused by the possession and use of handguns. According to Justice Breyer, people still had access to other kinds of weapons, including long guns, and the costs and benefits or the over- or under-inclusiveness of the district's regulation was well within the bounds of what a legislature could reasonably think is effective. In Justice Breyer's opinion, it wasn't for the court to second-guess this judgment. Second, Justice Breyer was critical of the majority opinion as a methodological matter because the court had failed to offer guidance about the actual appropriate way to examine future Second Amendment claims. All the kinds of the exceptions that the court had carved out, which Professor Lund had identified, felon in possession laws restricting guns in sensitive places, etc., these were all based on some kind of cost-benefit calculation made initially by legislatures and reviewed by a court. Justice Breyer would have just made this review more transparent in terms of what the court was examining in terms of such trade-offs, rather than hide them in a fog of unsupported historical citations.
Thank you, Professor Miller. So we're going to start now with the debate portion. And my first question is to Professor Miller. Will start off with the first question. And my question is, so one of the sharpest points of disagreement between Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens is over the definition of the militia and its relationship to the people. According to Justice Scalia, the constitutional militia consists of all able-bodied men, and the best analog today we might think of is the pool of men required to register with the Selective Service System. Justice Stevens paints a very different picture. He understands the militia more narrowly as comprising only those citizens enrolled in organized state military service, and today that might be members of the National Guard, basically a narrow pool of volunteers. So at the time of the framing, what was the original understanding of a well-regulated militia, and what was the relationship between the militia and the people identified in the Second Amendment?
Well, I mean, this is obviously a central disagreement between the majority and the dissent, and in some senses the question is now academic because Heller I take to be the law of the land, and Heller says that an individual right to have a firearm in the home for personal purposes like self-defense is what the Second Amendment means. So you know, to the extent that you're asking me to sort of relitigate Heller and relitigate sort of the original meaning, I think it's fair to say that the founding generation had quite a different conception in many ways about who could be members of this militia. They clearly thought that militia service was a duty. They thought that militia service was a duty that I think was incumbent to certain portions of the society. They had a what might be thought of as a sort of a Republican value kind of conception of The duty to prepare, to defend one's state, and in general the nation. That's a different conception, I think, in terms of its selectivity and inclusiveness that we have today. I also think that as a matter of sort of original understanding, or at least original intent, it's fair to say that their concern was against something like the existence of a standing army. But as history shows, it was very clear shortly thereafter that the original intent, to the extent it was to rely upon a militia rather than a professionalized army to defend the nation, just didn't last very long. At some point, the nation realized that relying on a sort of civic republican value of a republican militia just wasn't going to do the job. So,
thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Professor Miller. Professor Lund?
Okay, this is rather complicated, as Professor Miller has suggested, and I'll try to say this as concisely as possible. I don't think that Justice Scalia's opinion handles the relationship between the militia preface and the operative clause very well. So I'm just going to extremely briefly summarize my view, which is a little different. To understand why the preface is there, first you have to recognize that grammatically it does not modify or alter the operative clause in any way. Then you have to ask, why is it there? And that goes back to the convention, the Constitutional Convention, where there was a huge debate then and in the ratification debates over this massive increase in federal military power, which caused a lot of concern among a substantial portion of the citizenry. When the first Congress drafted the Bill of Rights, there was no intent to change anything in the original Constitution, and the original Constitution gave the federal government virtually plenary power to regulate the militia. The anti-federalists especially were very worried that that the federal government was given too much military power, but the Second Amendment did not detract from that federal power at all. So the federal government has almost plenary power to regulate the militia, and that includes defining it, defining the militia as it sees fit. So the preface in the Second Amendment is a way, I think, of paying respect to the people's fear of standing armies without doing anything to diminish the right of the people, which is what's actually which is actually protected. And if you think about the term well-regulated militia, the Second Amendment doesn't do anything to change the federal government's power to regulate the militia or to tell it that it must regulate the militia or anything else. All it does is say a well-regulated militia, and people would understand that a well-regulated militia is one that is not inappropriately regulated. And one inappropriate regulation, the one that's forbidden by the Second Amendment, is a federal law that disarms American citizens.
Thank you, Professor Lund.
I just wanted to chime in just 3 points. So the first is that I think Professor Lund is right in terms of the way Justice Scalia understands it, although, as I indicated in my opening remarks, there's some debate about whether that's an accurate understanding of linguistic conventions in the 18th century. The second is that Justice Scalia does actually talk about two different kinds of militias. There's the citizens' militia, the unorganized militia, and then there is the actual organized militia. I don't know what Justice Scalia thinks about the ability of, for example, Congress to regulate all of the unorganized militia itself. And the third thing, I think, is that We also have to understand the relationship between the militia and the citizens, not only through the lens of the 18th century, but through the lens of the 19th century, where, in fact, the militias become hotly contested in terms of their composition and what they do with respect to the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Thank you, Professor Miller. Professor Long?
If I may, just on that very last point, it's an important point, apart from the original meaning of the Second Amendment in the late 18th century. And there was a very extremely interesting episode during Reconstruction where Congress was very concerned about militias that basically consisted of ex-Confederate soldiers terrorizing the black population. And so a bill was drafted in Congress to disarm these militias in the southern states, and an objection was raised that violated the Second Amendment because it protects the right of those men to possess weapons. And in response to that objection, the bill was modified so that it disbanded the militia but did not disarm the individuals who had previously been in the militias.
Thank you, Professor.
Understanding there very similar to my understanding of the Second Amendment.
Thank you, Professor Lund. So on a related topic, another profound disagreement between Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens has to do with the underlying reasons why the Second Amendment was codified. So both agree that the framers feared standing armies and that this fear motivated the adoption of the Second Amendment, but their agreement ends there. For Justice Scalia, the right to keep and bear arms gave the citizenry the means to defend themselves, both against private violence and against governmental tyranny. For Justice Stevens, the right to keep and bear arms is the means by which state governments protect their sovereignty against the federal government. What is the relationship between the Second Amendment, the framers' fears of standing armies, and the right of revolution, and how do we understand the Second Amendment in light of other constitutional provisions defining treason and authorizing the federal government to suppress insurrections? Professor Lund?
Let me say first that people at the time, I don't think, distinguished at a fundamental level between your right to defend yourself against a common criminal and your right to defend yourself against a tyrant or a would-be tyrant. That understanding goes all the way back to Great Britain. It's articulated pretty clearly by Blackstone. So when they decided to enact the Bill of Rights, when they drafted the Bill of Rights, all they were doing was saying that the new federal government would not be permitted to do various things that a lot of people didn't think they would have been able to do anyway. So in that sense, they didn't have any reason to think about the exact relationship between the militia and the standing armies and that kind of thing with respect to the Second Amendment. It was just a completely non-controversial thing. Nobody thought that the federal government should have any right to disarm American citizens. That left the federal government with huge amounts of power, not only over to create a standing army and regulate it, but to regulate the militias. So nothing in the Second Amendment would have been controversial or was controversial at the time. Now, what's happened since then is that the concern about the danger of standing armies, which was foremost in the minds of the people who were thinking about the problem then, has subsided to near zero level. On the other hand, concern about gun regulations that infringe on people's ability to protect themselves from common criminals has increased dramatically. So there's been a shift historically in what the foremost concern was, but both of them were already there in the Second Amendment.
Thank you, Professor Lund. Professor Miller?
Right. So, first of all, I'm not quite certain that I agree that Justice Stevens believes that the only form of armed self-defense that can occur is through an organized militia. So in terms of the framing of the disagreement, I'm not quite sure I agree that that's true. But I think your larger point, which is and one that Professor Lund had identified, which is the sort of levels of abstraction and no distinction between defense against a common criminal and defense against the tyrant, I think I have a slightly different understanding of what the common law assumptions were at the time that the amendment was ratified, because as you might know, the sort of the law of self-defense, the notion that you could simply use arms to in your personal capacity to apprehend or to kill a criminal, was quite a bit different in their conceptions than ours. We think of it as a uniquely personal right. I think it's fair to say, with the exception of defense in the home, that the public use of weapons to apprehend or to kill criminals was always sort of understood to be derivative of a power of the state. In fact, the early common law in England of self-defense, there was no true self-defense. All homicides done on one's own volition were crimes, and you had to seek a special pardon from the sovereign. Now, over time, that changed, but the distinction between what one might think of as excusable homicide and justifiable homicide, that is, homicide for which there is some fault and homicide for which there is no fault, the axis of division between that was typically in the scenarios where an individual was doing self-defense in order to effectuate what was essentially a police action.
Thank you, Professor Miller.
Yep.
If I could just add to that, it's an important point, and I'm going to focus on where I agree with Professor Miller, which is at the time, what we think of as the right to use lethal force against criminals was both an individual right to defend your own life under the liberal principles of Locke and the Declaration of Independence, but it was also a duty to defend the community against criminals. And that came up in a kind of very striking way at the trial involving the Boston Massacre, where the only issue in the trial was who was the aggressor, the British troops or the upset citizens. But the judge in the case made clear that the citizens not only had a right to bring weapons to the town square or wherever it was, but they had a duty to bring weapons if there were any chance of trouble, because it would be their duty to help police and stop any illegal behavior. So again, the two things were tied up. The duty and the right were tied up together in people's minds.
Thank you, Professor Lund. Professor Miller?
You want me to respond? Yeah,
you have the option to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think where maybe Professor Lund and I disagree is to the extent that, the duties and the idea that individuals acting on their individual initiative are basically conferring or some sort of public good, I think that suggests that there is more room for government regulation in that space than the pure sort of liberal right sort of philosophy that we typically sort of today conceive of self-defense as being a part of.
Thank you. We'll come to the regulations in a moment. I have one last question on the individual versus collective right topic. So reading Justice Stevens' opinion, I have some question of how he separates the right to bear arms from a mere duty to bear arms when called for military service. And a right implies that there's some action that the government can't take. And I see at least two possibilities for the right in Justice Stevens' opinion. First, that members of the National Guard may, at their own discretion, maintain and use private weapons for military service, even in violation of federal law. Or second, that states may authorize their citizens to possess weapons for military purposes. And once a state government gives that authority, citizens may keep arms at home in violation of federal law. If Justice Stevens had prevailed, in what circumstances would the right to keep and bear arms be enforceable today? Professor Miller?
Well, I suspect that if you had a scenario in which the national government had said, you know, we're going to regulate the militia in such a way that we're going to basically deny anybody, National Guard members, any sort of weapons, and we're also going to, I suspect he would suggest, confiscate, or do a widespread confiscation of all private arms. My sense is that that would be an enforceable right, a deprivation. That is, I have a right to have an arm as a member of a militia, and you've denied me that right, and therefore it's a violation. I suspect that that would be so. There are lots of federalism sort of barriers to that, including the fact that even though the national government has the duty and the right to discipline, train the militia, the heads of the militia are still sort of state authorities, and so I think there would be certainly some political safeguards to such an action. But that's my sense of it.
Thank you, Professor Lund.
I just don't know what Justice Stevens would say if he were asked to elaborate on his position. I mean, the state's right position that he adopts has always had the problem that it seems to imply that the state governments have rights to create some kind of army that the federal government cannot deny to them. And that seems to be inconsistent with at least one and possibly two provisions in the original Constitution. One, the provision that forbids them to keep state armies without federal consent, and second, the virtually plenary authority that Article I gives to the federal government over the militia. So nobody at the time thought that indicated in any way that anything in the Second Amendment was amending or repealing either of those provisions. So I suppose that means that if Justice Stevens' position on the first issue of states' rights were adopted, they would have to figure out some way to limit the logic of their own decision. And I don't know how they would do that.
Thank you. So we've discussed the militia, the people, and the security of the free state. I would like to shift now to the regulation of the right, and first, the types of arms that the Second Amendment protects. Justice Scalia defines the arms protected by the Second Amendment as those arms in common use at the time for lawful purposes like self-defense. Extrapolating from the common law prohibition against carrying dangerous or unusual weapons to the terror of the people, Justice Scalia suggests that, quote, weapons that are most useful in military service, M16 rifles and the like, may be banned. He recognizes that this interpretation limits the degree of fit between the prefatory clause and the protected right, but he says, modern developments cannot change our interpretation of the right. So I have a two-part question here. First, is Justice Scalia being a faithful originalist in this passage? And second, what are the arms that the Second Amendment protects, at least as the amendment was originally understood? Professor Lund?
Well, I don't know how faithful Justice Scalia is being to the original meaning of the Constitution, since he pays no attention to it and just makes these announcements on the basis of no analysis at all. I think there's a good reason for that. Which is, first, there was very little to no demand for regulation of weapons during the founding period and for a long time after that at the federal level and even at the state level at that time. So people never had any reason to start talking about, well, what weapons are protected, what weapons aren't protected. There's no historical record on which to do a kind of some kind of originalist analysis. And the other thing that's significant, another reason why you're not going to find much use in history here is that the technology of weapons has changed so much since that time. At that time, the weapons that most people would have had were the same weapons that they would have taken with them to war. So nobody had to think about whether weapons of war are appropriate for civilian possession. It just wasn't thought about. It wasn't talked about. There was no reason for it. That means, I think, that instead of just making pronouncements of the kind that we find in the Heller opinion, the court has to do something like the cost-benefit analysis that that Justice Breyer purports to do in his opinion, but without the very heavy thumb on the scale in favor of regulation that Justice Breyer adopts. I think one of the powerful points that Justice Breyer makes is that Justice Scalia has also done a cost-benefit analysis. He just hasn't done it explicitly. And I think you have to give Breyer credit for having done it explicitly. I think if Scalia would have done it explicitly and properly, he would have come to the same conclusion that he did come to, that there's not sufficient justification for the ban in this case. But it would have been based on the kind of analysis that we see in the tiers of scrutiny cases, for example, and it would have been more transparent and satisfying.
Thank you, Professor Lund. Professor Miller?
So this is obviously a really difficult question. I think I disagree with Professor Lund in this sense, which is to the extent that Justice Scalia says that the right is simply a confirmation of an English-inspired right, there is quite a bit of record evidence of regulations of weapons that go all the way back to really the 17th century. So there are announcements by both the Tudor monarchs and the Stuarts about carrying certain weapons called dags, certain handguns at the time. So there is a regulatory system in place if we include within the common law all the pronouncement of the monarchs, going all the way really to early colonial regulations like New Jersey, for example, made certain pronouncements about regulations on certain types of pocket pistols and stilettos and daggers being carried. So I think that there is a regulatory environment. Now, to the question that of whether you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, I think it's fair to say that there is a cost-benefit analysis. The question then is whether we can talk about the fact that there were regulations of certain types of arms deemed dangerous and unusual as itself being evidence that the original understanding of the amendment of what an arm could be basically encoded some kind of cost-benefit analysis. It's clear that not all arms that meet a linguistic definition of what an arm is are protected or ever have been. And so I think it's fair to say that, like with an analog with the Seventh Amendment, just like you can imagine in the Seventh Amendment context, this is the right to trial by jury, lots of kinds of actions that didn't exist in the 18th century now get a right to a jury. Lots of things that didn't exist in the 18th century now can be counted as arms. But by the same token, lots of regulations of the jury through a procedural process that didn't exist in the 18th century are also constitutional. And I think that a parallel can be made in the Second Amendment context as well.
Thank you, Professor Miller.
Let me just respond briefly to the long history of gun regulation in England and the much, much spottier kinds of regulation in colonial America and early America. All of that's true. There were a lot of regulations in England and some regulations in the colonies and in the states. But that's pretty irrelevant to the question of the meaning of the Second Amendment, because the Second Amendment applied only to the state, to the federal government, leaving the states completely free to adopt whatever gun regulations they wanted, which is part of the reason there was no real discussion of the scope of the Second Amendment. There was no need for it. If the kinds of laws that are popular today ever came to be desired by the people of a particular state, they could adopt it. The Second Amendment wouldn't interfere with that at all. One of the peculiar things about the debate over the Bill of Rights is that nobody, as far as I know, ever asked whether the Bill of Rights would apply in the District of Columbia, the federal district, or the territories. And you would think that might be an important question, since if you're just assuming that the states can take care of all these kind of police power regulations, well, then what about the territories and what about the federal district? As far as I know, that question was just never addressed. So, again, we can't go back to the historical record to find out what people were thinking when they adopted the Second Amendment.
So if I can just respond very quickly, I think to the extent that we're supposed to extent the originalist exercise is to try to recover what people understood words to mean in a legal context that came from England, then I think it would actually be relevant what the English regulatory environment was, if basically the framers were protecting the ancient rights of English persons, English subjects, as part of what they were doing. If that's in fact what they were doing, then this regulatory environment would matter, and would matter for the Second Amendment, irrespective of whether in fact Congress had decided to exercise whatever regulatory authority that it had.
Well,
thank you.
The point is, Congress was never given any regulatory authority, and the Second Amendment certainly didn't confer any on it.
Well, I think my point is that if the idea of what the right to keep and bear arms means everything, including all the regulatory environment of England, then the fact that they don't actually exercise any of that regulatory authority that is encoded in what the right is, that it's, you know, what it covers and what it protects, is not evidence of the fact that they didn't think that they had it. They just didn't use it.
In England, Parliament had plenary authority, just like the states did here. And the Second Amendment certainly was not meant to be as limited as the right to arms provision in the English Bill of Rights, which applied only to the Crown. So it was very clear to the drafters of the Second Amendment and everybody else that that our Bill of Rights was going farther than the English Bill of Rights, or the analogs in the English Bill of Rights, because it applies to the legislature as well as the Crown.
Thank you. All right. We have completed the question portion that I had prepared, and I would like to now open it up for a public question.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you, professors, for a great start to the call and a great debate. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter the star key and then pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first question.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey. I'm a member of the Ancient and Honorable Huntington Militia, and we've been firing muskets and cannons on the village green since 1653. And we are a well-regulated militia, which is a citizen's militia, which is contrasted to the king's militia, which might be called the state militia or the National Guard. But the well-regulated militia was a citizen's militia. And the great failure of the citizens' militia was in 1812, when the D.C. militia was trying to fight the British invasion. And the guy driving the ammunition truck in response to some rocket attacks just drove off with the ammunition, leaving the militia disarmed. But that's a militia of politicians and government employees who are less reliable than ordinary citizens. Good kings under the English rights tended to want the people's militia, rather, and because they felt that the people were their greatest protection, whereas tyrannical kings tended to suppress the people's militia because they didn't want the opposition of the people. In the United States, the first gun laws were designed to disarm blacks after slaves were freed. And then Tim Sullivan was a criminal in New York State, and he set up the Sullivan Law because his muggers, who were his constituents, tended to be killed by citizens who were defending themselves. Tim Sullivan, the way he would win his Democratic nominations was to beat up his opponents and throw them out the window. So I think you're getting the entire concept of the well-regulated citizens' militia confused with the king's militia, and they are two distinct things.
Professor Miller?
Well, I don't disagree with that assessment. I mean, I think it chimes in with what Justice Scalia says in the Heller opinion. He's identified the unorganized and the organized militia. They are two different things. I think the question is, what is the relationship between the unorganized and the organized militia with respect to state power? So, if I think a thought experiment goes something like this. So when George Wallace was going to stop the integration of the University of Alabama, he had a plan, which I don't think he executed on, which was to call the unorganized militia in to stop integration. And I guess the question is, if the president of the United States had federalized that unorganized militia to actually pursue integration, would that have been a lawful command or not? And I'll leave it to the caller to figure out for himself if he thought that would be a lawful order or not. And I don't know, because it never came to fruition, but I think it's an interesting thought experiment.
Professor Lund?
I don't think I have anything useful to add. I'll
okay.
Pass.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, my name is Charles Nichols. I'm challenging California's ban on openly carrying loaded and unloaded firearms in public. 2 months ago, we had oral arguments in my case on appeal. The state attorney's position, representing Governor Brown and Attorney General Becerra, is that in 1791, when the Second Amendment was adopted, nobody carried firearms, or presumably arms in general, outside of their home because it was illegal to bear arms in public because of the statute of Northampton. According to the state's attorney, the mere carriage of a firearm was carrying a firearm in terror of the people. What comments would you have on that?
This is Nelson Lund. I'm not familiar with the latest developments in that case. This idea of bringing up the statute of Northampton is something that's frequently done. Whatever it meant in England, and it was not applied exactly as one might expect from what one hears about what it said. In the United States, it was. There's a long line of state cases before the adoption of the Second Amendment that makes it clear that as that case was understood in the United States, it was only a ban on carrying dangerous and unusual weapons in a way that would terrify the public and tend to provoke an affray.
So if they're arguing
that you didn't have a right to carry a gun in public in 1791 in the United States, that's just historically wrong.
Well, the state's position is I don't have a right to carry it outside the door of my home,
That's historically wrong.
Yes.
Professor Miller, anything to add?
I don't know if the law on the statute of Northampton is quite as clear as Professor Lund has said. I certainly know that some states adopted the statute of Northampton sort of extant. They didn't change it. I do know that eventually, especially in the southern states, that it was read to have a kind of intent requirement. There is some controversy as to whether that intent requirement can be read back into how, for example, an English person in 1791 would have understood the statute of Northampton. I certainly think that the tradition of regulating arms in public, not the prohibition, but the regulating of arms in public, is quite a bit more robust than what we might think of as far less regulation of arms in one's home. But I think that's, I think that's how I respond to the question about the statute of Northampton.
Can I ask a follow-up question on this? So for federal courts, these questions are new, but a lot of these issues, especially public carry, were heavily litigated in state courts during the 19th century. What precedential value, if any, should these state court decisions have for how we interpret the Second Amendment?
Is this to me or to...
Sure. Go ahead, Professor Miller.
Well, I think this is a bigger methodological issue, which is if originalism is trying to figure out not only what words mean, but what the law was at a certain point in time, and that's what we sort of understand as the how we understand rights, then I think there's a particular there might be a danger if you only look at the cases that actually get litigated, because you're going to have what statisticians call a selection effects issue, right? So you would, it seems like you would also want to know what were the status of laws that that were never challenged, and that would be the universe of information that you would need, just as a descriptive matter, to figure out what the law was in 1791 or 1868 or whatever point in time that you're concerned about. So I certainly think it's relevant. There are relevant data points, but I think that we should be mindful of the distorting effects that can be caused by only paying attention to those kinds of cases that actually got litigated.
Professor Long?
I don't think they're of much relevance at all in interpreting the Second Amendment. What happened in the states was, as time went on, the states developed an interest in regulating firearms more heavily than they had in the past. And those developments could not have been foreseen or were not foreseen by anyone who spoke, at least, about the Second Amendment. So they don't have much relevance directly to that. They might become relevant when you turn to the question of the incorporation of the right to keep and bear arms through the 14th Amendment. And that gets very complicated, and I don't know that we're going to have time to get into it here, but what I don't think is that we can simply take any regulations that the state courts have been very, very deferential to their state legislatures on the whole in considering right to arms challenges. And I don't think we can simply import that into the federal constitution. There's no good reason to do that.
Thank you. Let's go back to our caller.
That caller is now off the line, but we do have another question lined up. Is it all right if we go to the next question?
Yes, please.
Earlier, you were talking about the cost benefits of regulation. And I'd just like to point out in the 20th century, there were 18 million private murders committed worldwide. And at the same time, governments killed about 180 million of their own people. So that in terms of trusting someone with the right to bear arms, the average government is 500 million times more likely to kill you, your own government, than the average individual you meet. So that's one cost benefit that should be considered. The other is that the experience of right to carry in the states has been that whenever a state has introduced right to carry, violent crime has been reduced. One college town reduced rape by some huge amount simply by publicizing a program to arm women. So when you talk about the costs and benefits of regulation, it seems to argue for liberalized right to carry.
Professor Allen, do you want to start off with a response?
Okay, without getting into the very, very complicated debate about the net effects of gun control laws in this country in recent times, which is complicated, I think the thing to focus on with respect to the Second Amendment and the incorporated Second Amendment through the 14th Amendment is that the Constitution implicitly makes a cost-benefit analysis when it establishes the right. And that means that in interpreting the scope of the right, the courts ought to give it the broadest scope possible, consistent with sound reasoning. The courts do that with respect to every other provision of the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. All of those rights have costs. Plenty of people get killed because of the Fourth Amendment right preventing the police, Fifth Amendment rights preventing the police from putting criminals behind bars. Lots of people get killed or end up dead because of people's free speech rights. And of course, Scalia says, and anyone who has any sense would say, there has to be some limit on these rights. They're not absolute. They should be interpreted, I think, in the opposite way from the way way Breyer does it in Heller, which is instead of being deferential to the government, you should be deferential to the spirit of the constitutional amendment itself.
Thank you, Professor Long. Professor Miller, feel free to add.
Sure. So I agree with the premise that obviously, as far as the cost-benefit analysis of a world in which private ownership of guns is protected and not, the Constitution clearly errs on the side of protecting individual rights. That's what Heller's about. But I don't think that the question about what that right is and its meets and bounds is exhausted by just what the words say, as Heller itself indicates. It's not an absolute right. Not every arm counts as a Second Amendment arm. Not every person is entitled to a Second Amendment rights if that means to keep and bear arms. For example, the court says that felons and other persons with mental illness can be kept from possessing firearms. So there's a lot of details about the cost benefits that are going in, and then it's a question about how much are you going to try to determine that through case-by-case adjudication as opposed to deference to a body that can hold hearings and try to figure out whether more guns equal less crime or all the very contested empirical data.
Thank you.
We are approaching the 1:50. Oh, sorry. Did you want to add to that, Robert?
I did not. I was going to say we were approaching the end, and I didn't know if we want to do one more question or.
I will leave it up to you and the speakers. We do have another question lined up, so we could go to that, or we could adjourn.
Let's do one final question.
I'm happy to hear one more question.
All right. Let's go to our last question.
Well, this was Charles Nichols. The moderator had another question for me, but if I can substitute my question, I'm more interested in the effect of incorporation on the Second Amendment. Doesn't that change fundamentally what the Second Amendment was understood from 1791? Isn't it the understanding of the Second Amendment in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted that's controlling, at least against state laws?
In terms of the question of the speaker, I think as an intellectually honest way of approaching the Second Amendment, I think he's absolutely right. I think it's important to actually look at the Second Amendment through the lens of incorporation and the 14th Amendment and Reconstruction. I think that's absolutely true. If we look at a trend
line. Well, Reconstruction came after the 14th Amendment was enacted. So the Reconstruction era laws really wouldn't have, they couldn't dictate what the people who, the framers of the 14th Amendment thought, because they occurred years after.
Well, yeah, but the Civil Rights Act of 1866 is the first Civil Rights Act, and the Freedmen's Bureau Bill talks about the right to keep arms, and that exists before 1868, which is the 14th Amendment. So I think it's influential. I think the point, the bigger point is that I think you're right. The problem is that that's not how the court has approached many constitutional matters with respect to incorporation. They don't see that the 14th Amendment does anything other than simply apply it to the states and apply it in exactly the same way that it applies to the federal government in most circumstances. And so you get this sort of hybrid where you have you're trying to figure out how an 18th century right applies to states, even though a lot happens between the 1700s, the late 1700s, and the 14th Amendment. But maybe Professor Lund has a different position. I don't know.
I don't know that it's different. What I do know is that it's not perfectly clear that anything in the Bill of Rights was incorporated by the 14th Amendment as a matter of original meaning. And if it was incorporated, it would almost certainly have to have been through the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which is not how the court has ever done it. They've done it through substantive due process.
Substantive due process, yes.
So when you start talking about the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, I mean, you're kind of cast into a morass of uncertainty that's way, way beyond the uncertainty we have about the Second Amendment. And that comes back again, I think, to the ultimately unavoidable truth that the courts are going to have to develop a jurisprudence in the way that they've done it with other elements of the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment.
Well, so far they've followed Justice Stevens' footnote 13 in the McDonough decision. You might want to give that one a read. According to Justice Stevens, they would take the least common denominator and be highly deferential, which is what they have been.
And I think we could go on for a while talking about how the Second Amendment's been interpreted within the Court of Appeals. There has certainly been diverse tiers of scrutiny that have been applied by the various courts, and often very deferentially. But I think we are out of time, and we may have to save that conversation for another day. I want to extend a special thanks to Professor Lund and to Professor Miller for taking the time to be with us today and to debate these issues.
And I want to express my thanks both to the Federalist Society and to Professor Miller, who I've never had a chance to talk about these matters with, so that was a great pleasure.
It's reciprocal. Thank you very much to the Federalist Society, and it was great to talk through these things. I've read your work, Professor Lund, but haven't had a chance to chat with you about it, so I'm glad that we've had this opportunity.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of our experts for their benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info at fed-soc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.